Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Good evening. Welcome to the LSE. And welcome to Professor Mark Malik Brown's inaugural lecture as visiting professor and to a conversation between Mark and Stephanie Flanders on development after Trump. I'm Stefan Chambers. I run the Marshall Institute here at the LSE, and I'm delighted to be with you. Welcome to those of you in the room, people I can see, and welcome to those following us online from all over the world. It's my honour to introduce this evening on behalf of the LSE's School of Public Policy and the Marshall Institute. It's my duty to say that if there's a fire alarm, we should assemble outside, and stewards will guide and assist us were that to happen. And it's my pleasure to ask you to turn your phones to silent. Mark will speak for about 35 minutes, after which he'll be in conversation with Stephanie for around 25 minutes, and that should leave us about half an hour for your questions, which I'll take both from you from the floor and online. Those of you watching remotely, please use the chat function for your questions, and please let us know your name and where you're from, and if you possibly can, frame your questions as questions. This event this evening will be recorded, so both your brilliant questions and our speakers' insights can be rewound and remembered, but only if you wait, if you're in the room, for the mic to come to you so that we can tell. And you please also tell us who you are and where you're from. If the recordings turn out well, we hope to podcast them as part of the LSE Public Lectures series. Right, that's the preamble over. Introducing Mark Malik Brown is both easy and hard. It's easy because he's a friend and a colleague and one of the most influential figures in development of our age. It's hard because his achievements are so humblingly extensive that it's difficult to know what to say without spending an inordinate amount of time. I'll say only, therefore, that he's just co-authored a really interesting report on the Bretton Woods institutions at 80, and I commend it to you. If you're in this room, you're interested in that subject. If you're interested in that subject and you haven't already, you should read that report. Stephanie Flanders is an economist who makes complex ideas accessible, and I wonder if my colleagues are listening to that bit. She's head of economics and politics at Bloomberg and was previously at JP Morgan, the US Treasury, and the BBC. I'm particularly an admirer of her committed cycle enthusiasm. So that's the plan for this evening. I will look forward to your perfectly honed questions. Meanwhile, Mark, welcome, and over to you.
Stefan, thank you, and it's a real privilege to be here and to be giving this inaugural lecture. Thank you. Or first lecture. In 1988, a UK Secretary of State for Defence visited Malaysia. His actions at that time later led to a landslide change in British aid policy. He promised aid in return for Malaysia purchasing British arms. It led to the £234 million funding by the UK of the Pergau Dam, deemed an uneconomic white elephant of a project by UK officials. Tim Lancaster, the top Foreign Office development official at the time, refused to sign off on it. It finally went to the Prime Minister's desk, where Margaret Thatcher approved it. The Arms for Aid affair was a huge scandal at the time. Its consequence was a fundamental reset of British development policy. When Labour came to power in 1997, partly on the wave of an anti-corruption message, which included Pergau, it established a new separate department, DFID, the Department for International Development, so as to free development decisions from British trade and politics in the future. The new approach was confirmed in the 2002 International Development Act that determined that aid was for the purpose of poverty reduction alone. Intentionally, development spending tracked that, or internationally rather, development spending tracked that British example. At the United Nations, I and others, under the leadership of the UN's first black African Secretary General, Kofi Annan, introduced the Millennium Development Goals. They came on the heels of a civil society supported and inspired anti-poverty debt relief campaign aimed at lessening the burden of earlier aid for arms type deals in, at least in the case of the debt, the poorest of those developing countries. There were a number of sort of corruption poster countries such as Zaire, later the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Indonesia that had under corrupt dictatorships hatched similar scandals. Political upheaval and international outrage followed in both cases. The stage was set for a whole new era of development. The MDGs established at the start of the new millennium a set of stretched development goals for poverty reduction to be measured over the period 1990 to 2015. For a world opinion inured into the view that poverty is with us forever, the results were bracing. The number of people living in extreme poverty fell from 1.9 billion in 1990 to 836 million in 2015. The percentage fall met the goal of halving the proportion of those living in extreme poverty, measured as less than $1.25 a day at the time. The number of children not in school dropped by almost 50% over a 10-year period. There was a 53% reduction in child mortality and a 45% drop in maternal mortality over the 25 years of the measurement life of the MDGs. There was dramatic improvement in combating infectious disease, and often because of dramatic responses when crises occurred. When I ran the UN Development Programme, the sudden scourge of HIV/AIDS seemed likely to set back these health improvements. Instead, infection rates dropped by 40% over a 13-year period, and those on antiretroviral treatment increased from some 800,000 in 2003 to 13.5 million by 2014. That, in turn, avoided some 7.5 million deaths. I've argued elsewhere that those 15 years, 1995 to 2010, were the most dramatic decade and a half in human history in terms of global progress for humanity's poorest third. Inevitably, perhaps, progress was uneven geographically, as many have noticed. China disproportionately drove these global numbers with its billion-plus population. But there were substantial gains elsewhere. And while good national policies counted for more in this success than official development assistance, ODA, the alignment between good national governance, good ODA, and dramatic progress towards a fairer and juster world was exhilarating to see for a senior development official like myself. The sins of Pergau had an apparently happy legacy, a development atonement. There was a healthy engagement by ministers at both ends, donors and developing country alike, prime ministers, finance ministers, development and planning ministers. A galvanized world was on the collective move to make life for its poorest citizens better. But there was still a long way to go. Poverty might have been down, but income inequality was persistent, and life remained very hard for the world's bottom third. New challenges like climate-related threats were endangering progress. Natural disasters were on the rise. Farmlands and cities alike were subject to weather trends that disproportionately hit those on the worst land, the poor. The earlier generation of threat had provoked bold and innovative responses. For example, it took a coalition of countries, big pharma, foundations and international organizations and civil society to both bring down the cost of antiretrovirals to treat HIV/AIDS and to ensure their wide distribution. Having participated in many of the negotiations that got us there, I recall just how tough it was. Commercial self-interest didn't meekly give way to life-saving altruism, but Kofi Annan and others found ways through. Humanity was well served. But today, the shadow of Pergau is back. Just give one example. The US has proposed in Zambia a health compact, one of several dozen such that it has suggested in its successor arrangements to USAID. It would provide $1 billion over 5 years, or less than half of what it had been providing before Trump took office, but still $1 billion. But in return for access to Zambia's critical minerals and to Zambia's private health data, Zambia would give American companies similar access to its mining sector that China has enjoyed, together with the citizens' health data for the last 10 years. Understandably, the government is balking. The US, anxious to overcome this hesitation, has threatened to suspend its ongoing antiretroviral funding. Around 1.3 million Zambians are currently being treated on the US PEPFAR program. An internal State Department memo argued, quote, "We will only secure our priorities by demonstrating willingness to publicly take support away from Zambia on a massive scale," end quote. How did this reversal come to pass? How is it that such a rare global public policy achievement, that progress against poverty and improvements in life expectancy, that at times seem to enjoy the support of left and right alike, take such a fall? Received wisdom, and indeed the title of this talk, suggests a one-word answer, the expletive of the age, Trump. Yet in truth, the reality is a bit more complex than the early antics of Trump and his chainsaw-waving accomplice, Elon Musk, when at the start of this second term, USAID, the world's largest bilateral aid program, was shuttered. On February the 3rd, 2025, Musk wrote on X, quote, "We spent the weekend feeding USAID into the wood chipper. Could have gone to some great parties. Did that instead," end of quote. No wonder it has become the defining moment in ODA's immolation. Cuts elsewhere have been quieter, less celebrated affairs. The US started with a bang, falling from $63 billion in 2024 to $29 billion in 2025, a whopping 57%. But several points of context. Global ODA as a whole dropped 23% over 2025, the largest annual drop ever. And the US Congress has actually sought to restore some of the cuts the US made, meaning that as a percentage, the UK, which has cut over the last few years from 0.7 to 0.3, cuts initiated by both a Tory and then a Labour government, will have cut more proportionately than the US. And across the EU, The story is the same. Of the 17 EU states that are DAC members, that's the OECD's Aid or Development Committee, cuts average nearly 10%, and the EU institutions themselves cut 14%. Further, a fifth of Europe's ODA spending goes on meeting the domestic accommodation costs of illegal migrant flows, the hostels here in the UK. And it's a sort of disputed DAC stretching of what counts as aid. What it's led to is that in almost all countries, the biggest recipient of their aid is themselves, domestically. And the European cuts started first. France has come down about 50% from President Macron's high point of French aspirational leadership on ODA soft power. Germany, which inspired under Chancellor Merkel to be Europe's leading player in Africa, has fallen back, as have traditional ODA superpowers like Sweden and the Netherlands. Yet from their publics and our public here, barely a peep. The case made by governments has been tight public spending and increased defence spending as the world tips back towards conflict. And there is, I suspect, a meta dimension to this. In the post-1989 world, there was, in political terms, something of a post-Cold War political dividend. A new generation did not have to weigh overall public spending through the lens of national security interests. There was a rare moment of international harmony that allowed ambition to take wing, an aspiration for global cooperation and solidarity to end poverty was no longer confined to the political left field. It came into the mainstream. In the 1990s and early 2000s, as an international development official for the World Bank and then the UN, but as formerly a political consultant, I got into the habit of researching public opinion data before visiting European ministers and parliaments. Aid had become good politics. Among younger voters, it was often more of a determinant of long-term intention, voting intent, than past party affiliation. Elevated by the debt relief campaign and the MDGs, it had become in many places a significant national issue. I knew it myself when my elderly uncle, a church warden in Sussex, asked me about the MDGs that his vicar had raised from the pulpit. In 2005, as the number two in the United Nations, I was asked to speak at both the Labour and Conservative Party conferences in the UK. Aid was in. Just as today, it's out. Polling reveals exaggerated assumptions by publics everywhere as to what is spent on aid. But even more a resentment that at the time of domestic cuts, money is diverted to foreign causes. That resentment taps into a deeper vein in our contemporary politics, the insecurity, economic and cultural, of the workers and middle managers of the old economy, a politics that sees its fiercest expression in its opposition to migration, its sense of betrayal by almost all incumbent governments of left or right, and as an associated casualty, its scepticism about aid. One of the most enduring tropes about aid is that its attacks on the West's poor to subsidize the South's rich. In a world of rising internal tensions, and indeed international ones, as growing numbers feel let down by their country's politics and rising global tensions as we revert to power not law as the means of regulating international relations, it should be no surprise, perhaps, that ODA is in crisis. And indeed, the argument of those who would restore it is essentially a pre-Pergau one. Reposition it as a tool of national policy, make it about British exports and British national interests. However, first we need to understand that ODA's crisis is not just a northern donor one. When Musk swung his chainsaw at USAID, there was not the outrage across the global south either that many might have expected. And this, despite analyses from and predictions from The Lancet and the highly regarded Centre for Global Development, that possibly millions of lives were at risk because of those cuts. Partly this lack of reaction is that southern ministers, like their northern ones, were reluctant to prompt Trump's wrath. His Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, has brazenly but repeatedly asserted that not a life would be lost because of the cuts. Perhaps also too many ministers remain regrettably detached from their country's front line of needs. A rural health clinic cut off from vital medical resupply may not be the top priority for the minister in the distant capital, but there is something else too. ODA, despite its author's good intentions and its success, had never escaped its history. Not now the Pergau history, but an earlier one of empire and colonies. It was present in the DNA of its beginnings. Support to countries largely under European colonial rule, a means in later years to prepare them for self-rule and self-government and later independence, but nevertheless one that meant priorities and direction were set from the Western capital. Later this led to ever more detachment between the real needs on the ground and donors lurching from project to project and sector to sector as different development theories fell in and out of vogue. Community development, microfinance, education first, no, public health first, the private sector, climate, before often the giddy roundabout would begin again. A great benefit of the MDGs was even though they had the same colonial birthmark in some respects, they did allow a consistency of approach over a critical 15-year period. The successor Sustainable Development Goals, the SDGs, are unfortunately so all-encompassing and inclusive of so many priorities that they have made no such useful straitjacket and today are honoured more in their breach than likely achievement. So from the crash and burn of the old ODA system, there may be a silver lining, an opportunity to build a new development finance system that is centered on developing countries themselves. A power shift or revolution even from the donor-created strategies of the past. And here, Stefan was kind enough to refer to the report that I and two others, the former finance minister of Indonesia, Sri Mulyani Indrawati, and Patrick Achie, former prime minister of Cote d'Ivoire, wrote for the leadership of the two Bretton Woods institutions, the World Bank and IMF, on their future, like the UN 80 years old, like the UN wondering which direction to go in future years. And very simply, you know, we wanted to put at the center of their calculations this shift, this, if you like, this historic break with the colonial model of ODA and a move towards developing country ownership of the development process. A country's ability to set its own good development goals and pursue them relentlessly and strategically without deferring to others' outside imposed alternative objectives and priorities. And we felt that in that world, it was possible to scale finance through various new, less orthodox sources, the private sector, domestic resource mobilization, but also enhanced lending by development banks like the MDBs. And we imagined that could lead to a relaunching of these institutions, much more as cooperatives jointly owned by their North and Southern members and far away from the colonial model of the first 80 years of their life. Turning first to the country ownership point, I think all three of us, and in the case of my Indonesian co-author, she has before resigning last year, had presented something like, I think it was 17 budgets as finance minister, with a gap in the middle when she'd served in a senior role at the World Bank. But when she began, she had almost no bench strength of her own. A couple of internationally educated colleagues with PhDs, but no real ministry capacity to challenge the development strategies pushed her way by the World Bank, by big donors and others. By the time she left office, her team knew an awful lot more about the development prospects of Indonesia than the World Bank officials with their tours of duty in the country or their cycle of work on a particular loan or sector did. And indeed, the same for the UN or the British or the American aid officials who were there. And so for us in the report, perhaps the most significant diagram is a simple one, which says that development success comes where countries have the political will to really drive a long-term development strategy and the institutional capacity to support that drive. And all three of us felt, from long decades between the three of us in development, that there was no substitute for that national leadership and strategy-setting role, and that it far outweighed choices about pro-market or not pro-market policies or a prioritizing of education over private sector development or infrastructure, that what mattered was consistency of objective, and that there were many routes to successful development, but common to them all was governments which enjoyed the political support to continue with a single strategy over many years, and in the case of democratic governments, one where that consensus about priorities survived changes of government at the ballot box. And, you know, we have consulted and talked with quite a few of the development economists who similarly embrace this point now. I think Stefan Dercon is, you know, arguably the most well-known UK sort of champion of this view. But the new book by Joe Studwell, What Makes Africa Work, you know, is another very eloquent expression of it. But behind this idea of, you know, countries taking charge of their own development, of winning a agency which, in a sense, was which some have started referred to as a sort of second decolonization, is this issue that, done right, it allows a mobilization of a much more varied source of finance than before, and that countries on that path have access to private capital to enhance domestic resource mobilization, because many have traditionally retained very low rates of domestic tax, etc. So there's a whole set of things which can be done to improve that. And this allows the much reduced volume of ODA to be retained in a sort of triage-like arrangement for where it is most needed. And we argue that it is needed for the growing humanitarian bill that the world faces as conflict spreads as a result of this changed, tragically changed geopolitical environment, and as a hardcore of stubbornly fragile states need support which the private sector and others are not going to provide them. And we expect that a reframed ODA with a more limited set of goals of humanitarian, fragile states, and global public goods, where there is a shared burden which is not, if you like, development in character, but where tackling climate and other transnational issues is something that affects us all, that an ODA remade around that more clear and limited set of priorities can over time recover public support, indeed recover it as the politics generally heals in our different countries. But it does, and this report was about the Bretton Woods institutions, so it does also require them to step up in a dramatic way. And as somebody who worked at senior levels on both UN side of the table in terms of development, as well as for the Bretton Woods institutions, you know, it is a subject, it's a matter of great grief to me that the UN, with its grant-based funding model, has been hit much more severely by what has happened in terms of falling ODA numbers than the Bretton Woods institutions, which have this partially paid-in capital model, which allows them to borrow against government guarantees in the capital markets and therefore retain and even increase their capital, their lending flows, you know, even as the rest of ODA, the ODA aid environment craters and diminishes. So we, I think, have to expect that these institutions will be an even larger part of development going forward. But just a word on the private sector side of development funding, which has been a, you know, for frankly many years, a persistent disappointment for those in development, where projects are arduously put forward, where the private sector, it proves often in the end of the day more risk averse than the public lenders like the World Bank or its private sector arm, the IFC, or the regional development banks. Nevertheless, I think we are moving towards various new instruments, both on the political risk side, but also in terms of securitizing and bundling loans that these public institutions make, and a bit like our mortgages, selling them on into private markets, which will finally start to unlock a much greater volume of private finance for development. And the great matching point is that just as people contribute to pensions over a 30 or 40 year lifespan of working lifespan and, you know, want the pension to have appreciated by the end point, the great glory of development funding as against so much funding in already sort of slow growth, low productivity economies such as ours, sadly, in Europe, is that you have that prospect not of short-term returns, but of very healthy long-term returns as the countries of the Global South, you know, hit transformational economic numbers. And it's worth saying that not for the first time, we at the moment see some of the higher growth economies in the world in Africa, sitting, of course, beside others which have not achieved that kind of growth. So just one final thought about the new model, which is that I suspect it will be much more multilateral than bilateral. That, you know, it's very hard for the UK, as it completely diminishes its own ODA, to pretend to its own bilateral program anymore. And the latest round of spending choices that the government has made seems to recognise that, with bilateral support very much reduced to the humanitarian space, and even there very significantly through UN and other agencies, and a recognition that for development its money needs to be pooled with others if it is to have any efficiency of impact. And that second, this sort of post-colonial sort of new sovereign agency of developing countries, their own leadership of development, is much better supported by multilateral provision of funding than a bunch of bilateral donors each tugging at their own priorities. And I think the other change which we'll make, and a less happy one in many ways, but perhaps politically a healthy one, is that as ODA is replaced by a set of financing from the private sector to domestic resource mobilization over which the West has much less control, the influence of global civil society to press for changes on an array of social issues in developing countries by arguing for the conditioning of World Bank lending or UN grants to countries or DFID programs in the past is going to be much diminished. It really is going to be countries which are making the choices about their priorities. And one can only hope that their domestic civil societies will become champions and advocates for many of the agendas that until now have often been led, understandably, but not, as I say, politically necessarily healthily, by international civil society. And so, you know, you see it playing out in a country like Kenya, where a lot of brave local advocates are still trying to protect against the worst extremes of anti-LGBT behaviours by the government, but where it's harder and harder for international civil society to be heard on these issues. So we're moving to a very different world, and, you know, I end where I began, which is, you know, after Pergau, we realized that development wasn't working. We constructed a new system which gave an extraordinary 15 to 20 years of transformational global change. It's fallen apart. We not unreasonably blame a lot of that on Trump, but as I've tried to argue, the reasons are deeper and wider than that. And as we look through the smashed architecture of a rare global success story and wonder how it came to this and begin the business of reconstruction of it, we need to build a much more modest house than before and to put countries themselves at the front of this and their leadership be the thing behind which we all seek to march. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Mark's the only person, I think, in my professional life, when if I ask to speak for 35 minutes, he speaks for 35 minutes. So, and it is very rare, and it's also extraordinarily precise. So thank you, not least, for that. I built a conversation between Stephanie and Mark, so I will shut up and allow that to happen.
Well, thank you, Stefan, and I can't help, as I listen to Mark, I guess a tiny bit of the backstory of I first encountered Mark would have been what, the mid 1990s, something like that, at the Financial Times. But then I was at the U.S. Treasury, and we were overlapping in various ways. And I guess really one can't help thinking what another planet that seems. When I was working at the U.S. Treasury, the competition there was between my boss Larry Summers and the UK then Chancellor of the Exchequer Gordon Brown for who could do most to reduce the debt of the highly indebted poor countries at the next summit. And there was it was a very healthy competition for those countries, and I think for development assistance as a whole, that they want to be the ones with the shiny new idea, even if it costs quite a lot of money. We are, needless to say, not in that world anymore, although Gordon Brown is making a new appearance. And I actually wanted to ask you about that because, I mean, I really appreciated, I think the same tone was in that Bretton Woods report, quite sort of brutally realistic, your assessment of how things have changed, certainly appropriately somber, but not fatalistic, which, you know, is something that we all kind of battle with these days in different contexts. And I guess in that context, it's worth remembering you not only highlighted that a lot of the cuts had been worse outside the US, we have actually seen the Trump administration be persuaded to not only sort of maintain or at least put up with the fact that a lot of the total assistance that was put through the wood chipper last year has been restored in some sense. But what the actual assistance is, I mean, much of it has changed. And you gave an example with the Zambia, you know, rather very concerning Zambia example. But overall, Congress has been able to fight back around 80% of the headline cuts in US assistance last year. And perhaps most strikingly, the US has continued to support the IDA, help funding IDA, the most subsidized forms of loans given by the World Bank. And I wonder whether that's, you know, certainly R.J. Banger thinks that he did a very good job of sort of selling that to Donald Trump. Maybe one lesson is you need a kind of self-made man, a businessman, a banker, to make the case for these things to Donald Trump. And I think the fact you mentioned, the sort of efficiency of that money for IDA that MDBs have that a lot of other forms of assistance don't have, that every $1 is able to produce many more dollars of assistance. That obviously was appealing to the president, but it's still international. It's still the most subsidized, most foreign aid-y bit of what the World Bank does, and this is a president who doesn't like the idea of foreign aid, especially not foreign aid that he can't completely control. So I just wonder, you know, are there lessons there for sort of not giving in too quickly in fighting for that sort of core principle of development assistance? I'm not claiming, not suggesting that you are, but I do know those who are involved in the G20 preparations, the UK hosting the G20 next year, that's an opportunity to put some of these issues on the agenda. But they've already been told that it can't use the word development or climate in any of the communique or any of the sort of UK initiatives. And I just, not, you don't necessarily want to talk to those negotiations, but if you're thinking about the G20, thinking practically about how to apply your vision, should we, you know, make sure we're not sort of giving up too quickly on that core ideal of assistance?
Yeah, I think, Steph, you're completely right. I mean, just on the US numbers, I mean, I think there's still a risk that the restored numbers will be underspent by a very significant amount because they'll use techniques like rescissions and just not spend it.
And there's a fraction of people at the State Department
to do it, overseeing it. And so, you know, something like the Food for Peace program has now been moved to the Department of Agriculture, and, you know, and so it's a bit of a mess. And I think the Congress, you know, the Republicans who joined the Democrats in restoring the aid are deliberately being a little quiet about it because they don't want to provoke Trump. So, you know, it's a fragile recovery, really, which doesn't, you know, wouldn't survive, you know, much of a sort of political counter-push in Washington, I think. But it's important, and I do agree with you that this IDA issue goes to my point about the relative health of the World Bank and the regional development banks versus the UN system and versus countries' own bilateral systems. And it is partly this efficiency, and it is also a recognition by ministers that actually combining resources, if you've got much less, is, you know, it's more necessary than ever. I think Ajay Banga, who was very much an appointment, not just of Biden, but of Kamala Harris lobbying for him within the Biden administration, has done a very deft job of moving to now enjoy the support of the Trump team. And, you know, he is a former corporate CEO of MasterCard. He's moved in Republican circles. He's, you know, a great friend of Trump's infamous son-in-law, etc., etc. But, you know, the difficulty is if you accept this thing that you can no longer talk about climate, and it's a banned word at the World Bank now, pretty much too. You know, it's very hard to sustain the political case on climate that you need to sustain. I mean, it's a tricky uphill one because it's always about investing now for gains that are not going to be seen for perhaps a decade. So of all areas of public spending, climate is one of those where, in a sense, a politician is forced to say, we're doing this for your children. You know, it's not got a sort of instant gratification often in terms of investments. Not always, because there's plenty of short-term stuff to do that does have that effect. And so, you know, I think we are in at that strange moment where, you know, Trump has come behind it. And by the way, in his first term, he also agreed, before Banger, he agreed a capital increase at the World Bank, which surprised everybody there too. But I think it's a sort of efficiency thing. And I think perhaps one final point one should make is that in the same way I said at the end that, you know, people are trying to argue for British aid by saying a sort of pre-Pergau argument is in Britain's trade interests to do development. Unfortunately, there's something similar now with the World Bank, in that Scott Bessent says quite publicly to fellow ministers of finance, Scott Bessent being the US Treasury Secretary, look, I have to show the president that the World Bank is actually an agent of, you know, American economic foreign policy, because otherwise his MAGA people are going to, you know, want it to go. So the only defense of it is it's a cheap way for America to build pro-American markets and strategic interests around the world. So the real risk is that, you know, far from it retaining its multilateral character, that the price of retaining American support is that it actually begins a process of de-internationalizing, where a rival set of institutions which are there created, you know, China already has its own version of the World Bank, and, you know, that we're going to see these institutions lose their international character, and that would be a huge price to pay.
There is sort of a, you've captured like the tension that I was kind of feeling in some of the different things that you were saying earlier, because on the one hand, we all tend to think multilateralism is dead, at least in the sense of, you know, the multilateral system, a commitment, however sort of illusory, to a set of global rules and institutions, to countries working together under a shared set of rules, that's gone now.
Yeah.
And you've got the sort of Mark Carney middle powers have got to get together and forge our own compacts and arrangements. On the other hand, you're saying the only ones left standing, really, when it comes to development assistance, are these deeply, possibly too multilateral institutions. They're so multilateral, they often find it hard to do anything. So I guess, one, is there a kind of tension between those two things? And two, if one of the sort of risks is what you've identified, that it just, that the bank gets sort of captured in some sense by a Trumpian agenda, you know, we would all worry that it makes it even harder for the bank to be sort of quietly or not so quietly pushing back against the kind of erosion of institutions and policy-making capability that you talk about, that's kind of embedded in the very transactional approach of that Zambia proposal. Mm. You might have wanted to have the bank pushing against that. What you've described may be a possibility of it actually ending up contributing to that, in which case should we be very glad that it's so hard to change the bank? There's no way that Trump's really going to be able to capture it.
Yeah, no, there we are. A case for institutional conservatism. And look, I mean, I think we've got to see how this plays out. I think you're right that if it's just this second Trump term, you know, the bank will weather it and come out the other side and rediscover climate, and, you know, things will have some, there'll be some stability. If, you know, Trump was succeeded by one of his lieutenants, you know, I think it's going to get much harder, and I think we might well see these institutions struggle to survive that. As I say, I mean, the perverse thing is that these two, World Bank and IMF, both Washington-based, have huge financial strength but political weakness because of their Washington home. The UN has much greater independence, not just because New York's a few hundred miles away, but because, you know, its whole membership structure gives it a genuine sort of spread multilateral ownership in many ways, but no financial strength. And, you know, it's going to be very interesting to see how these two sets of institutions survive this. In the case of the UN, almost certainly we're seeing a crystallizing of the arguments about the UN and its future around the beginnings now of a race for the next Secretary General, with, by the way, hustings here in London in late May. Let me tell those who are interested in such things, where some of the candidates will appear in person.
Will the preferred US choice be bothering to come to hustings here?
Apparently he is. He's signed up to come.
He being?
Rafael Grossi, an Argentinian who is head of the International Atomic Energy Agency at the moment. And, you know, clearly, I don't know him actually, but clearly a quite deft international official who, given the strange election nature of the job where you have to avoid a veto from any one of the P5, you know, is in quite good standing because he seems to have won, not the public, but the implicit support of the Americans, the Russians, possibly the Chinese, by not offending either any one of these three nuclear powers on a subject of great sensitivity to them, their nuclear arsenals. But, you know, there's a long way to go before the end, and I think we'll see other candidates emerge. And, you know, in fact, I'm one of my sort of great pushes at the moment is trying to persuade this British government, if it stopped for long enough from sort of trying to survive, to think about the rest of the world. You know, I've been trying to persuade Britain to say that it will not support any candidate who hasn't first won the apparent support of the General Assembly and subjected themselves to cross-examination by the GA and, you know, emerges with some kind of consensus from that body. Only then would Britain allow that candidate to pass through, which, you know, might give this embarrassing legacy thing that the Brits have of a Security Council veto might actually regain them some genuine standing at UN.
That's interesting. Be a sort of test of spine, potentially. There's just a couple of things I wanted to just sort of throw at you, but also because I suspect there'll be some questions about it. I mean, one thing that was a little bit buried in your remarks was the disappointment of private finance. And I guess if you were being harsher, you'd say not only that it's disappointed for a long time, but it has just been a monumental delusion.
Yeah.
Not just kind of in the kind of constant discussion around this for development assistance. And most recently, I guess, it was the Private Investment Lab, which was supposed to do great things. And then I guess it doesn't help that the person who was running it, Mark Carney, then decided to go and be Prime Minister of Canada instead. But I'm also thinking of the climate piece, where there was enormous expectation and a lot of big numbers bandied around, and then very little, at least the stuff that was really sold as pro-development, that was going to be the private money in climate, really quite hard to find. So I just wonder, is a lot of that in the BWI Adeyi report, but is it just a dead end, at least in the way it's been described?
Well, I think, Steph, you know, going back quite a way, actually, to the two figures that you mentioned, Larry Summers and Gordon Brown, politicians have had a very bad habit in sort of using a sort of false arithmetic about the private sector. They'll make these big international pledges of billions into trillions, and Larry was involved in the Addis Ababa process in 2015, where first this sort of trillions thing started to come up, and Westerners, those two included, but many others since, less admirably, have, you know, tried to match the gap between the de minimis public funding and the goal they've just pledged to by saying the private sector will fill the rest. And it's become this sort of default phrase for international conference setting, how the demands of developing countries are met by embarrassed northern officials who don't have the money in their own budgets to do it, so say private sector. And, you know, what began as a minor sin has expanded into a major one as the numbers have grown ever further apart. And, you know, behind it has lain the fact, and I've seen this having spent time working on the boards of private companies or, you know, both investment companies and infrastructure and other ones. And, you know, what you see is that even though the rates of return are much higher often in developing countries, an awful lot of the process around project preparation, diligence, securing early financing for the feasibility studies, the first stages, is all a lot harder. And so, you know, and as when we did the Bretton Woods project, as a number of bankers very eloquently said during our different hearings and seminars, was, you know, remember the diligence on a 20 million health project in Zambia can be every bit as time-consuming and costly as the diligence on a 500 million health project in Germany. So which one are we going to do? And so, you know, there's remained this sort of private financiers struggle to get above the project level, and certainly not to scale in a way that matches these sort of loose words of international politicians and agreements. So, you know, now I think we're finally getting, as I said in my remarks, to some tools such as securitization and political risk, which does come out of the private sector lab, yeah, which are beginning to bridge some of this difficulty.
Just going to interrupt for a minute to start you thinking about your perfectly honed questions, because in a minute I'm going to open, not quite yet, jump the gun, but in a minute, but yours is clearly already perfectly honed, and I won't forget.
I guess, just to quickly on that, I think it's been good to get to those more refined tools, but your subset, even in the case of using those tools, the bit that you're bridging between something that would have happened anyway in the private sector and something that's just short of the line, I just think is a much shorter bridge than you tend to think. And the things that are left behind are really quite a large part of what we think of as development, whether it's global public goods, everything in the least. The poorest economies, you're just not going to get private sector. So I just think, again, it's sort of this... you're not going to stop, I guess, politicians injecting the bicycle pump to all of these things, but it's... you'd sort of feel like experience ought to be there as well. The final thing I just want to throw in, maybe that's because I'm sort of living more in the day-to-day now, at Bloomberg, and the sort of global, the reporters and economists are, on the economics and politics side, are trying to map the impact of the Iran crisis, which has been such an example of the continued integration of this global economy, despite best efforts. And also the reality that you know better than most, that the biggest impact, the most negative impact from this crisis is going to be in the poorest economies. You know, a high oil price is a rationing, and a high fertilizer price, a high kerosene price is a rationing mechanism.
Yeah.
And it'll still go to the rich, and it won't go to, yeah, countries and people that can't afford it. So, you know, I said, my first question, I talked about the G20 as a sort of quite near-term example where people in the UK are now thinking about how to apply the principles that you're doing. But there's also a very short-term emergency, which is an opportunity and also just an urgent, presenting an urgent need to think about what is support going to look like right now in the face of this. And I just wondered what you think well-thinking policymakers ought to be trying to bring together on this?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, there have been various abortive efforts to try and, which I think were just sort of unrealistic, to sort of free the fertilizer flow. You know, there was various initiatives. The UN Secretary General announced something in that regard, but, you know, the idea that the fertilizer was going to get through and the oil wasn't, and, you know, it just didn't make much plausible sense. So, you know, there is a real need to move very quickly from the point of view of these countries to, you know, getting a solution which opens the straits. And, you know, there's been underreporting, and I'm sure you're following it very closely at Bloomberg, but, you know, in general, there's been a certain coyness about African countries admitting just how serious the situation is. You know, they're worried that then, you know, investors will run in the opposite direction. But I think the other just point to make on these sorts of situations is, you know, yes, we have to solve the Gulf situation, but you know, but yes, we have to solve Ukraine, we have to solve Gaza. But, you know, you take Ukraine, last year, there was more ODA of this much diminished pool spent on Ukraine than all LDCs, least developed countries, together. So there's that other dimension to it, which is, you know, this prioritization of these flows around Western priorities, which again, you know, I think is a happy casualty of these cuts, that's going to be a lot less easy to do in the future. Something like the Strait of Hormuz is as much a South problem as a North one. In that way, it's totally different to Ukraine.
Thank you. Okay, I promised you that it would be your turn to ask Mark and Stephanie questions, and I promised you that I would honour yours being the first hand up. So here in the front row, please. I see, and we'll try to remember other hands as we go along.
Yes. Hello? Yes. My name is Stefano Bonfo. I'm an ex-United Nations expert, so I spent about 5, 6, 10 years in United Nations family. And my observation is regarding this sustainable development goal of United Nations. My impression is that the goal of United Nations organization is led by, we can say, politicians and economists. No science is there. This means the impact is very low of all the program of United Nations to developing countries. So we should take more attention to the science, to the data, to the innovation, and then therefore maybe we'll be more, let's say, sustainable impact. Thank you.
You want to take more?
I'll take that one and then I'll bundle some together.
Well, look, I think it's absolutely the case that, you know, I have watched over a career in development of, you know, in areas from agriculture to many others, an absence of good science in the way that programs have been designed. But equally, I've seen where there's been, you know, a lot of science, stuff go spectacularly wrong, and you know the Green Revolution is a clear case of where there were massive productivity gains and a generation of people feeling that you know science had proved itself, you know, only for, you know, falling agricultural productivity rates as soils become exhausted and as the science moves on. So yes, more science, but thoughtful, climate-sensitive science as well, at least in that sector.
Okay. So we have a question at the back at the top, and then a question at the back at the bottom, and then I will add in some online questions.
Hello, good evening. Thank you for the talk. So basically, I have two questions. The one question being that when you gave the example of Zambia, so a thing came to my mind that is it the time that the debates that were taking place during the new international economic order, that debates be revived, like permanent sovereignty over natural resources when we see the link between development and critical minerals? And the second question being, why do you think, I cannot understand, like, why private finance, private parties will be interested to finance and development, like what will be their motivations behind it, because they have certain other notions which they give priority to if national governments are not giving priority to it. Thank you.
Okay, so that's a question about natural resources in less developed economies and the incentives for the private sector.
Hi, Stephen Paduano, LSE alumnus. So building on Stephanie's point on the shock and the consequences of the war, this is certainly something that we're seeing across lower middle income countries, serious balance of payments deterioration, depletion of reserves, and it's definitely bringing conversations about debt sustainability to the forefront. But also one of the issues that we're seeing is that it's not surfacing in bond prices right now. So the impetus of policymakers to actually engage in a debt treatment of any sort is simply not there. And they're all capable of returning to the markets and issuing again, even if it's too expensive, even if it's at 8, 9, 10%. So the question is for the UK, and perhaps also for France with their G7 year, but for the UK with their G20 year, there's a big focus on doing something around debt, but we can't find a country that will actually participate in a debt treatment of any sort. No country wants to restructure, no country wants to reprofile, even if they must. So it sort of goes back to an issue I know, Mark, that you've spent a lot of time thinking about, which is how do we deal with this sort of borrower reluctance to engage in certain policies, even if it's, you know, sort of clearly in line with the fundamentals for their own good? What are the carrots that should be used, or perhaps the sticks that should be used, to get countries to show up for restructuring?
Got it. And we have a number of questions coming in online, one of which is relates to what we've just heard, which is, you know, is it really possible to align private incentives with development imperatives? And the other brings up a question close to my heart, which is, should philanthropy play any kind of catalytic role in some of these developments? So we have kind of three bundles of questions, one about natural resources, then a big set around the relationship with private finance. What are its incentives? Are the returns, as Siad Lima online asks, actually kind of categorically in opposition to this? And why the? How do you solve the debt reluctance conundrum?
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ ask social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Okay.
I'm hoping
for some help from Stephanie. Look on the private sector one, the point is the private sector is only a portion of the financial flows that a country needs. Its own resource mobilization, concessional finance where it can still secure it, are critical other portions. And, you know, and it, because the private sector works only, as you, the two questioners rightly pointed out, in certain sectors, in certain kinds of economies. It is not some sort of universal panacea, and that's been the problem with this, you know, constant argument that the private sector will lift us from billions to trillions of flows. You know, it will help where it can see a way to make a profit. You know, what I tried to argue was that there are now large private sector patient flows related to the long investment span of the pension industry, particularly in the related savings industry, where, you know, actually the fact that developing countries have a higher annual rate of growth than developed countries allows you to secure those returns over time. So I think, you know, there is both an attraction to the private sector and an opportunity, but it will always, I mean, to take the Zambia point, be much more towards the mines than health provision or education. And so, again, you need this mixed financing model where government's own resources, you know, or its ability to borrow is used to meet these social sectors, which are not necessarily investable or are only investable for certain segments of the population that are willing to, say, pay for private health care. So I think that's, you know, a key issue. On the foundations, you know, I mentioned the Green Revolution. You know, that was very much initially something which was, you know, critical partners were both, you know, Indian agronomists, but also the Ford Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation. Or in my own experience of the HIV response in Southern Africa, again, there were critical foundation partners. In its time, the Clinton Global Initiative helped me make the first really successful multi-sectoral partnership in Botswana, which actually became the model which got emulated across, you know, other countries as well. So foundations can have an absolutely critical role at the beginning, at the creation of important new initiatives. And you've seen them try to do the same in the climate space. And, you know, I led a foundation, the Open Society Foundation, for some years, and, you know, was very interested in how our capital could be more risk-taking and both more urgent when it was needed and also more patient when it was needed, because we didn't have, you know, the only person we had to keep on side was a founder donor. Whereas, you know, if you are the steward of public funds, you have the taxpayer and many other constituencies to satisfy. So foundations are critical, but there's a tendency to overestimate the scale of resources that they can bring to bear, which, you know, means they become the new private sector, the default. Oh, the foundations will fund it, which in a sense is as misleading as the earlier claim the private sector will fund it. Just on the debt point, and Stephanie, I'm tempted to bring you in because Stephen, who raised that, is somebody who has worked with me, including on this BWI report, and has a very similar pedigree to yours of US Treasury and the rest, so asks very tricky questions, is my general experience. But just look, Stephen, I think, you know, we're again, you and I both know with these debt crises, there's an awful lot of calling wolf. I mean, where, you know, countries that we all anticipate are going to go over the edge, it's going to become unsustainable, there's going to be a debt crisis, somehow they steer around it, and then Western finance ministers become very complacent and believe that you're going to continue to have this pattern of crisis avoidance. And often it's crisis avoidance at a huge domestic cost to the country, and I take both Kenya and Nigeria as recent examples of that, which, you know, they just didn't want to get themselves into a debt situation because they thought it would deter, you know, their commercial lenders, investors, borrowers. But, you know, I do think if we see this radical increase in gas and fertilizer prices and kerosene prices, and knowing the sort of balanced payment situation in quite a few of these countries, you know, it's going to hit us. And of course, yet again, Western finance ministers will be looking somewhere else entirely when it does. So I think, you know, there is a looming crisis, which, you know, you're right to remind us of.
I thought Stephen's questions, I mean, it made, I would probably end up with where you've ended up. On the way to that answer, I was thinking of conversations I've had internally at Bloomberg where there's a sort of a surprise, and, you know, from an investor standpoint, you know, normally when you have an event like this, and certainly if you have an oil crash, you know, everybody would be selling emerging markets, selling what you would call the more frontier markets that overlap with the kind of countries that we've been talking about, the least developed economies. Talking in sort of purely investor standpoint, they've been a much better investment in the last 2 months than you would have expected. Now, part of that may be just what you mentioned, that countries are not really fessing up to how low their reserves are, how exposed they are. I think there's another piece that has to do with how unattractive all these core economies now are, and the sort of risk, you know, saying that these emerging market economies and even the frontier economies are highly risky when they actually have potentially much lower debt and more stable fundamentals, you might argue, than, say, the UK, at least this week. I think there's an element of sort of repricing, reassessing the long-term sustainability of a higher level of debt in these countries. But I still, with all that, I think the real explanation is, on the one hand, investors being a bit myopic, and on the other side, the stigma that still is there, and you identify countries just not. And the stigma is not just stigma, right? It's, as Mark points out, there have not been many positive examples of a restructuring process over the last few years, not least because there's been so much wrangling over the Chinese element, the difficulty of bringing the various vendors together. I did notice, and I was going to ask you about this actually, because one of my colleagues had noticed it at the spring meetings, the borrowers platform had been, I think is now being run by Egypt, but it's a UN run or a UN organized group trying to get borrowers together to have a bit more of a collective view on debt issues. But I don't get the sense that that's really going to be an answer.
I don't think so. I mean, it was launched, as you say, at the meetings. It's an outcome of this UN process where they'd met in Seville earlier in the year. And, you know, it has a good intellectual pedigree. It's come out of work by a bunch of economists, Joe Stiglitz, others. But, you know, the difficulty is that when it comes to finance, there is a very ingrained, weighted view that it's the business of the World Bank and the IMF, not the UN, which is viewed as too political in how it handles this. And so, you know, while yes, it was launched and people have hopes for it, you know, in some ways, I still think the IMF's attempt to launch, you know, a debt forum, which was rebalanced away from the Paris Club to give a bigger role to India and China and others, is probably, even though it's had a very slow start and it's not really got any teeth to it, but I suspect it still will have longer legs than the UN one.
I can see four, possibly five questions. One at the far left, physically, not politically, down here. One in the second row, white top, and then front row there, and then hand up in the second row. So let's make this brisk because we're in the final furlong.
Alex McKenna, and I teach in the Department of Government here at LSE. Question for Lord Malik Brown. Given the general thrust of your remarks this evening, can I take it that you were not and are not a particular fan of the last Conservative government's decision to fold DFID into the Foreign Office to create the FCDO, which was obviously in many ways was a bit of kind of signalling of this idea of transactional relationships between countries, but actually the fact that the many senior diplomats now actually feel that there's a bit of a reverse takeover going on, that actually DFID perhaps has the upper hand within the institution, and they're not particularly happy about that. So just your thoughts on that.
So my question is for Lord Malik Brown. My name is Alex Pedacci. I'm a student here in London and I'm studying for my A-levels. My question is, given your experience in development economics and funding, what policies or funding schemes do you think would best address the issue that 2.8 billion or 40% of humanity in this current moment lack adequate housing?
Sorry, did you say housing?
Yeah.
Got it? Okay.
Thank you for a very interesting talk. My question is for the both of you. I'm a student in the International Development Department, and regarding the philanthropic foundations, yes, there is an underestimation of resources, but I want to understand how we can balance personal interest, as the Gates Foundation is now the largest funder to the WHO. And with decreasing ODA, how do we make sure that philanthropists are not steering the global health agenda that's not rooted in actual evidence on the ground?
And the last one was, I think, in the second row there, at the top.
Yep. Hi. Good afternoon. My name's Deep. Quick question. I'm a development economist. My quick question here, so for those who want to get into international development or have come to institutions like the LSE to potentially switch into development, should they just forget about it? Or where should they actually go? Yeah.
Great question. Okay, so we have four questions. The first is about the DFID and the creation of FCDO, which is a UK specific question about the merger of two government departments. Second question is, how does any of this address the question of housing for large numbers of people in the world? How do we check the unelected influence of foundations on development, if I understand your question correctly, and should we all give up and not bother, is being the last question, or should we think about
the younger people?
Yeah, should we think? Should we think that this is a interesting and promising field to work in?
Right. Well, look, when DFID was swallowed up by FCDO, it was widely viewed as, you know, an early sign, as you rightly say, of this sort of political weakness for DFID. It had just sort of overgrown itself. But of course, you know, for years, the very best civil servant recruits were going into DFID. I mean, it had reached the point where, you know, they were choosing DFID even over the Treasury, the place that fast-track recruits had typically gone in the past. And, you know, one or two people, Riley observed to me at the time, that this was less, this takeover of DFID by the Foreign Office was less about the weakness of DFID and more about the weakness of the Foreign Office. Because, you know, what does a Foreign Office designed and living in its massive grand premises on King Charles Street actually do when its country has become a rather second-tier player in the world? And so, you know, there was this mismatch between a diplomatic establishment and its ambitions and the real international weight and fortunes of the UK. And so I think, you know, some cynics felt that by getting DFID back, it not just quadrupled or quintupled the budget of the Foreign Office, but gave it back a purpose and role. It's been an unbelievably, you know, difficult merger with, you know, a fall off in development effectiveness and performance really at a dramatic scale. And, you know, while yes, I think, you know, a lot of the DFID people have ultimately done quite well in the new structure, an awful lot of really good ones left too. And, you know, more critically, it's just has politicized so much of the work and mission of development in the way I described. So you're quite right. I think it was a terrible idea, badly done. And, you know, really not the only idea where the vanity of Boris Johnson and the desire when he was foreign minister to have walking around money and be able to promise prime ministers when he visited that there would be a new school or a new clinic, you know, led to the destruction of a very important new British institution. On housing, I would put that, you know, along with, you know, housing for me, you know, it's all about poverty, really, because, and income inequality, because, you know, and you don't, the solution to housing is not a building solution. It's an income distribution question and a spending power question and therefore a purchasing capacity question. And, you know, there are lots of ancillary corollary points, like, you know, if you, as I have, spent many decades going in and out of Africa, first, you know, traveling the length of the continent as a gap year student, as possibly some of you have done, and then going backwards back there over the decades very frequently. You know, I've seen the explosion of the cities on that continent, as I had in Asia before, and the unplanned nature of that explosion means that obviously the housing crisis is in many ways worsening because, you know, people are moving to cities and they are largely unplanned often. So you're right to draw attention to it. On Gates and health, you know, I would say 2 points. I mean, certainly, to be honest, the Gates Foundation probably invests an awful lot more in science and data than most government donors do. But that's not really an answer to your point, and I understand that. Which is about influence. And, you know, here I think, you know, the Gates people themselves have over the years become very conscious of this, but the reality is that, you know, America has slashed its funding to WHO and the Gates Foundation stepped in to make up a significant part of the difference. You have to put guardrails in place to prevent them becoming too decisive a voice, but, you know, the one, as I say, encouraging thing is they are actually a science-driven foundation. And, you know, but it's a very difficult balance. You know, what do you do? Do you not take the money and then, you know, there's no public health or no WHO-supported public health. So it's a tricky balance. And all I can tell you is knowing the leadership of Gates well and knowing the board and the individuals on it, they all agonize over this same issue. It's not that it's, you know, a foundation there trying to, on behalf of Big Pharma, seize control of the world's health and reframe it as a commercial money-making opportunity. It really is decent people struggling with what they recognize is a real issue of how do you try and contain your influence while wanting to exercise your diligence rights as a major funder. So it's challenging.
And just on that, I know we've got got the more existential question still to end on, but just to add to that, I'm slightly thinking I have that sort of famous Joe Biden phrase in my head, you know, don't compare me to the almighty, compare me to the alternative. I think sort of 20 years ago, we wouldn't necessarily have wanted that, the degree of influence and share of that kind of funding to be in the hands of a private organisation, even one with all of these guardrails. We probably also wouldn't want private companies to be deciding the guardrails for the use of AI and things that could, you know, fundamentally undermine our financial system. But given the alternatives, I think we're in a place where we should be looking at the institutions, you know, the transaction, just as the governments have become more transactional, well, maybe we should be judging some of these private institutions by their own guardrails, checks and balances, institutional mechanisms, and as Mark was saying, both the sort of level of expertise and the commitment of the individuals, and I think some of the institutional guardrails in places like within the Gates Foundation. It's definitely not perfect, but you would end up trusting them over quite a lot of other governments at the moment, I would say.
Yeah. So to the existential one, young man, go out and re-register in the mathematics department. No, listen, I actually think it's going to be, you know, a very different development world, but actually one which is going to be every bit as exciting, if not more exciting, with, in its way, as much opportunity, but no longer, like in so many areas of economic activity, no longer the clear progression career ladder of joining the UN as a young professional and working your way up through the ranks. Because, you know, the new masters of development, as if I'm right, are going to be the developing countries themselves, and a host of organizations which will work there and support them, some international, some national. And, you know, I'm on the board of ODI, for example, the ODI Global, the leading UK development institution. It has fellows in several dozen countries working for the national governments and finance ministries and planning ministries there. And, you know, that kind of assistance, I think, will grow as countries develop their own leadership. There will also, dare I say it, be the private sector players who are going to have to build teams on the ground, who will vary from, if you like, your sort of hard-headed critical mineral investor through to social impact investors at the other extreme. And, you know, so I actually think there's going to be an abundance of opportunity, because the one thing you step back and can say is the majority of global growth, just given the demography of the world, is likely to be in what we call the global south over the next 30 years. So you're going to exactly the right place. Just the institutions whose doors you knock on to get that first job may be very different to what you anticipated.
Also, I mean, if you were going to draw up a list of professions for which there is no longer a clear path, I think it would be a very, very long list, and development assistants would just be one of them. And is, you know, as a parent of one undergraduate and one soon-to-be undergraduate, obviously this is something that I think about a lot, and I think when we were thinking about that broader change to the labour market, to careers, to the value of humanity that we're all sort of assessing in the age of AI, you know, it strikes me, at least at the moment, one of the great weaknesses of all the chatbots and all the AI is the lack of understanding of how things actually work on the ground. You might have a great plan for building a power station, but how do you actually do it in this country, in this place, and how many trees are there between that field and that field? And that's something that AI does not know yet, and I think will not know for a very long time. And that's the kind of thing that's very much bound up with development assistance, and doing development, as Mark describes. So as long as you're willing to get your feet and hands dirty, I think you'll be all right.
So go into development. It's a great note to end on. It remains only for me to thank a number of people and groups of people. First of all, thank you to the LSE, where we are and where this conversation has been entirely consistent with the things that a serious social science research institution should think about. Thank you to the co-hosts for this evening, the School of Public Policy. Thank you to my colleagues at the Marshall Institute. Thank you to anyone wearing a red T-shirt stewarding us. Thank you to the audience online and to the audience here in London. It's gratifying that so many of you have given up a Monday evening to think hard about a hard set of questions. And of course, thank you to Mark and to Stephanie. I can't think of more expert voices to weigh in on some of these tricky questions. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.